you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. I'm joined by Atlantic staff writer, poet, and host of the popular YouTube series Crash Course Black American History, Clint Smith, whose New York Times bestseller is How the Word is Passed, Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Clint, thank you so much for being with us today on Air Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on the reception to the book. It must be very heartening for you, all the time you put into traveling the country, talking with so many people, to see the book being so widely embraced.
Yeah, it's been a really remarkable couple of weeks. You know, as a writer, you spend years working on something and you never know how it's going to be received in the world or what moment it's going to come out into the world. And so I think certainly the fact that it has come out in a moment where we are having this national conversation around how history is taught or not taught in our schools, critical race theory, Juneteenth becoming a national holiday, and the like, I think it is certainly entering the world in a moment that has made it ripe for discussion.
So let's talk about the concept behind the book, and you're traveling to different places and talking with people there. What was at the heart, the sort of the seed of the idea behind this that you were intending to convey?
Yeah, so the origin of the book is began in 2017 when I watched Confederate statues in my hometown of New Orleans come down. And I was watching these statues of Robert E. Lee, P.G.T. Beauregard, Jefferson Davis come down, and thinking about what it meant that I grew up in a majority black city in which there were more homages to enslavers than there were to enslaved people. And what does that mean? What does it mean that to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Highway? That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy? That my parents still live on a street named after somebody who owned 150 enslaved people? And what are the implications of that, and what does that mean? Because symbols aren't just symbols. They are reflective of the stories that societies tell, and those stories shape the narratives that communities carry, and those narratives shape public policy, and the public policy shapes the material conditions of the people's lives, which isn't to say that taking down a statue of Robert E. Lee is going to erase the racial wealth gap, but it is to say that it is part of an ecosystem of ideas and stories that helps shape how we understand what has happened to different communities in this country and what has to be done to repair that harm. And so I was thinking about that in the context of New Orleans and how it was reckoning with or failing to reckon with its relationship to the history of slavery, and decided to try and broaden it out and try to explore how different places throughout the country and across the ocean were thinking about their own respective relationships to that history.
A couple of years or so ago on the program, when the Confederate flag issue became such a big one nationally, we did a segment where I invited our African-American listeners who grew up in the South to talk about their perceptions of the Confederate flag and what it was, presence it had growing up then. And it was a range of fascinating calls that we had throughout the segment. But I was struck by a number of the callers saying that it actually didn't really give it much thought. It was just sort of there in the background. And as you were describing your childhood, you know, growing up with all these symbols and names of the Confederacy, I'm wondering, did you focus at all, or is it just sort of when you grow up with it, it's just there?
Yeah, I mean, I think I felt similarly in many ways. I mean, it was just a part of the landscape of my childhood. It was the iconography that ornamented the city that I loved. And it was, I guess I never asked a lot of questions about it because there were so many of them. There were so many statues of these white men on horses and on pedestals. And we most certainly were not taught about who they were in any way that I can remember. And I mean, it wasn't until I got older and started engaging with this history. And I was like, why is there a statue of P.G.T. Beauregard in front of City Park, you know, in this place where like literally I would be feeding the ducks and the geese, you know, pieces of bread with my mom when I was a child, underneath the shadow of this man who was a general in an army that was predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery. And the sort of quiet insidiousness of that didn't become clear to me until I became an adult. And I think what also became clear is how much of the history of this country that was right in front of me had been hidden from me purposefully or not for so much of my life. And I think when I began to encounter that history and excavate that history, I had a new language and a new framework and a new toolkit with which to more fully make sense of so much of what I was seeing around me and so much of what I had seen in this country for years.
We're talking with Atlantic staff writer Clint Smith, whose new book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America, is a New York Times bestseller. If you want to have questions of him, you want to talk with him, our lines are open at 866-893-KPECC. Clint, of course, you know, all Americans are taught in school about slavery. We're taught about the Civil War. We're taught about the issues that were at play during the course of the war. We're taught about Abraham Lincoln, the Emancipation Proclamation. What aspects of American history is taught about slavery and enslaved Americans is missing?
I mean, I think part of what's missing is a deep dive on how that history shapes our current political, economic, and social infrastructure. So one of the places that I went, for example, was Angola Prison. And Angola is the largest maximum security prison in the country. It is 18,000 acres wide, bigger than the island of Manhattan. It is a place where 75% of the people held there are black men. Over 70% of them are serving life sentences. And it is built on top of a former plantation. And what I tell folks is that if you were to go to Germany and you had the largest maximum security prison in Germany built on top of a former concentration camp in which the people held there were disproportionately Jewish, that place would rightfully be a global emblem of anti-Semitism. It would be abhorrent. It would be disgusting. We would never allow a place like that to exist because it would so clearly run counter to all of our moral and ethical sensibilities. And yet here in the United States, we have the largest maximum security prison in the country where the vast majority of people are black men serving life sentences, many who were sentenced as children, many who were sentenced by non-unanimous juries, which has since been rendered unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States, who go out and work in fields of what was once a plantation for virtually no pay while someone watches over them on horseback with a gun over their shoulder. And so when I go to a place like Angola, it's like, what is the way that the history of white supremacy is not only enacting physical violence against people's bodies, but also collectively numbing us as a society to certain types of violences that in another global context would be wildly unacceptable. And what ways has the history of that land shaped what that land looks like and how it operates today? And what does it mean that that place has a gift shop where they sell shot glasses and coffee mugs that say Angola, a gated community, almost to make a mockery of the thousands of people who continue to be held on that land? So I think places like that is an example of how we fail to adequately make sense of how that history continues to shape so much of our society today.
We're talking with Clint Smith, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. We'll continue our conversation with him in just 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on KPECC. So good to have you with us. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with LAPD Chief Michael Moore on the program. Thursday, we'll be talking with former LAPD Chief, former New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton will be with us. That's coming up over the next 2 days. Air Talk right here on KPCC. Right now, we're talking with Atlantic writer as well as a poet and very popular YouTube educator Clint Smith, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Anchor in Chatsworth called to ask, can you elaborate on the global connection of American slavery with countries in Africa and also with Europe? You, of course, in the book write about your trip to Senegal in West Africa.
Yeah, I think that part of what I wanted to do in that chapter was think about the origin point of the transatlantic slave trade. I think, you know, it's one thing to explore the places where these captured Africans were brought, but I also wanted to explore the places they were brought from. And so I went to Senegal, to Dakar, to Gorée Island, which is a small island off the coast of Dakar that is famous and infamous for being the site of where many thousands of people were taken before they crossed the Atlantic and went into the New World. And part of what I wanted to think about was sometimes this idea that like Africans sold or the Africans into slavery can be used in bad faith and can be used to in a way that lacks complexity and nuance to reduce or minimize the culpability of Europeans in the slave trade. But the thing that people have to recognize is that the idea of like blackness being an inherent phenomenon that ties people of different regions and cultures and ethnic groups together is very much a Western imposed racist phenomenon, right? Like that it was created in order to create a social hierarchy of economics and power to legitimate the slave trade and to legitimate racism and the social hierarchy thereof. So when you have somebody who captures another person during war and is a prisoner of war, and then they trade that person for goods, that is not like in the same way that we would never suggest like, oh, England and France were at war and it was like, you know, white brother against white brother and they were white brother was killing each other. Like no one would ever frame it that way because these are different countries, different ethnic groups, different people in the same way that it was in these African nations. And also being a prisoner of war is different than being part of an intergenerational system of chattel and an intergenerational system of being a part of a lower caste. And those small nuances and small distinctions are important and can often be flattened by some folks who attempt to engage in this, engage in these conversations without any sort of nuance. And I also just wanted to understand how I explored how like people in the United States, you know, students in the United States are taught about slavery or are not taught about slavery. And I wanted to understand how students in West Africa are taught or are not taught about slavery as well.
What are they taught in West Africa?
Yeah, I mean, I only spent time with one group of young people. And so this is not at all a sort of definitive account or portrait of how all West African students are taught about it. But I think it's very much put in conversation with colonialism, right? I mean, part of what's interesting is I was there, and in the same way that we're having conversations here in the States about, you know, streets named after Confederate leaders or streets named after enslavers or streets named after white supremacists, they're having conversations in Senegal about like streets that are named after people who colonized those countries. And the many of these European countries only left these West African nations in the 50s and the 60s. So this history is even more recent for so many of these countries than it is for us here in the US, where it is similarly very recent in the scope of human history. What was interesting is to think about the parallels of the way that there's a reckoning with the history of colonialism taking place in many West African nations and a reckoning here with the role that slavery played and how both of them are exploring how those phenomena continue to shape what the contemporary landscape of inequality looks like in these respective places today.
We're talking with Atlantic staff writer Clint Smith. His recently published book, How the Word Is Passed, Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. I'm struck by the conversations that you had with people at the locations you visited, like Monticello, like Confederate Cemetery, different places. And were you surprised by the nature of some of those conversations when you talked with people about the reality of the history?
I don't know if I was surprised. I mean, sometimes. I mean, I think I tried to approach each conversation with openness and generosity. I mean, one of the chapters that stands out to people is the one you alluded to at a Confederate cemetery, Blanford Cemetery, which is one of the largest Confederate cemeteries in the country, with the remains of 30,000 Confederate soldiers buried there. And it is a place where I spent the day with the sons of Confederate veterans and United Daughters of the Confederacy. And I wanted to genuinely understand what would lead someone to believe some of the things that they believe, like slavery wasn't the central cause of the Civil War, or slavery was not a horrific institution, and that there were, in fact, many benevolent slave owners, or all sorts of things like that. And I just wanted to understand. And if you approach somebody from an antagonistic perspective, then they're not going to open up to you. And so while I clearly did not agree with what they were saying and thought that it was like wrong on the most profound and fundamental levels, I think I let the book do that work rather than me trying to, antagonize or play gotcha with them in person. I think I let the primary source evidence and the historical documents and the historians say what needs to be said, and let that scholarship sort of dispute the erroneous nature of what these folks were saying for itself.
We're getting close to the end of our conversation, but real quickly, do you feel like the conversations about America's history and enslavement is becoming more authentic?
I think we are in a better place than we have been for, and certainly in my lifetime. Obviously, there is still a lot that needs to be done, an enormous amount. But I think that we are having more sophisticated understanding, and more people in this country have a more sophisticated and nuanced toolkit and language with which to make sense of racism, not as just being an interpersonal phenomenon, but a systemic one, a structural one, a historic one. And that, what that allows is for us to more effectively identify, again, why this country looks the way that it does today in really important ways.
Clint Smith, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Coming up next, it's Fresh Air on KPCC. Today with guest host Anne-Marie Baldonado. Guest will be Renee Elise Goldsberry, one of the stars of Hamilton, now one of the stars of the new series Girls 5 Eva. Have a great day.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.